Okay, this is Bernie Wise, the naturalist, and today I'm going to interview a friend of mine, Henry Kaplan, who had an unusual career. He had a vet's practice, but he had a special kind of relationship with a lot of other animals. So I want Henry to say hello and introduce himself, and we'll get going here.
Yeah, I'm Henry Kaplan. I'm a veterinarian. Had a small animal practice in Rockland County for about 40 years, and before that worked for several other veterinarians and spent 2 years in the Air Force, and I'm glad to be here today with Bernie.
Okay, so why did you become a vet, Henry?
Well, I always had an interest in science and had an aptitude for it, and veterinary medicine included the two things that I enjoyed the most, which was medicine and animals. And I found myself able to combine the things that I loved initially, even going through high school, when I worked for veterinarians for several different practices. And over the summers, I worked for veterinarians as well. And so it was natural for me to go to do my pre-veterinary work at Cornell, and then on to the Cornell Veterinary College.
Okay, so Cornell has a pretty good reputation as a vet school.
Yeah, I think it's rated among the top 8 or 10 veterinary colleges.
Okay, so from speaking to you before, you said that you spent time at the Catskill Game Farm. So tell me how that came about.
Sure. When I graduated from Cornell Veterinary College in 1962, I signed on with a veterinarian that had a mixed practice that included both large animals, cattle, horses, sheep, and a small animal hospital as well in Catskill, New York. And part of his practice was that he was on contract with the Catskill Game Farm to go to the game farm every day and treat whatever animals needed treatment on a daily basis. In fact, it was a requirement of law that a veterinarian come to any place that wild animals were being kept every day to make sure that the care was humane and that they were getting good veterinary care.
Okay, good. So, but his own practice was large animals also, like horses and cows and stuff like farm animals?
It was probably 40% large animals, 50% small animals, and 10% the game farm.
Right. So when you started at the game farm, was this something exciting that you could get a chance to work with animals that you wouldn't normally work with?
It was both exciting and frightening because there's very little literature that you can go to when a kangaroo or a rhinoceros or a camel is sick. And so you kind of have to think on your feet and extrapolate from what you know about cattle and horses and hope that a zebra is like a horse and that a rhino is like a cow. And unfortunately, medically, it's not always true.
Okay.
So it became difficult at times and kind of frightening, but also very exciting, as you suggest.
Yeah, so I know that I have a friend on Long Island who was a vet, and when the circus would come to town and they had a problem with an animal, they would call on him, and it was the same story. What did he know about snakes and, you know, other critters in there? So I asked him, how did you decide what medicines to give them and how much to give them? So he said, well, I did like humans. I would weigh the animal if I could and do it by weight and figure if I was going to give him a tetracycline or something like that. He figured a dose is similar to humans and all that. So he said that he used a lot of antibiotics for the animals. If there was some kind of infection, he said he used an antibiotic to get rid of it. And he also said, he told the owner of the animals, he said, give him aspirins also. So that's, you know, like two aspirins and call me in the morning.
Exactly.
But if you're a big hippo, I don't know how many aspirins he would take and call him in the morning. So can you tell us, Henry, some of the animal cases that you had that were really unusual and interesting and how you handle it?
Sure. As you suggest, the dosing the medications was always difficult in that humans take very different doses from animals. And within the different species of veterinary medicine, the dosages are very, very different. So it was always almost an experiment as to how to use a drug, because a drug can be good and a drug can be bad. And so we would, as you suggest, try and weigh the animal and extrapolate from the nearest species that we had an amount of drug per pound, but sometimes we weren't right. And unfortunately, most of the time it was nothing terrible, but sometimes the medicines wouldn't work or something like that just because we weren't giving the right dose. But thinking back on some of the cases, almost all the kangaroos that came in have ringworm, which is a fungus that humans can get. It's what's called a zoonotic disease. A zoonotic disease is a disease that's transmissible from animals to humans. And so handling kangaroos was always difficult. And we had a lot of large males. And as you know, they box. And they're very dangerous.
And they kick.
And the way they kill, defend themselves, is to bring up their hind legs and shred your abdomen with the claws that are on their hind legs. So they would grab you with these little front legs and kick the bejesus out of you with their hind legs. And so we had a lot of trouble, a lot of boxing matches where we would go in with kangaroos with ringworm that we really didn't want to rub up against because it was very contagious, and trying to restrain them, and restraint is a major problem with wild animals.
Did you use tranquilizers and stuff?
We used a lot of tranquilizers, some of which could be injected into their mouths, just squirted as a liquid into their mouths. So if they attacked you with their mouth open, you would squirt the tranquilizer in and get out of the cage quickly and sit down and have a Coke. And after half an hour, they would be laying on the floor of the of the crate. And so you could treat them safely that way. But some of them were by injection, and some of them were tablets. And so it became a real concern of how to safely restrain an animal without, you know, anesthesia or tranquilization is always finding the region that is between being effective and death.
Right.
Anesthesia is always walking a fine line between effectiveness and death.
Right. You go a little too far and they stop breathing.
And certainly our resuscitating equipment was very primitive. And so we always had to play the game where we'd give an animal tablets, let's say a kangaroo tablets, to make it get tranquilized and go in there to try and treat it. It would jump up and chase you out of the, out of the cage, which kind of takes the fun out of the whole
thing. That's true. That's true.
So, and we treated camels. I had a camel that had a stone in its urinary bladder. And we had to anesthetize it and get this to break up the stone and get the stone out. And their urinary passages are very different than cattle or horses. And so it becomes an exciting and very interesting and rewarding part of practice.
So is there much literature on treating animals like this?
There must be some body of literature. There is some for zoos.
For zoos, right.
But the game farm had a relatively small library, and we had in our practice a relatively small library. And unfortunately, we had to go on the game farm, or fortunately, every day, and never knew which book to bring because we never knew which animal was going to be presented to us. It might be a monkey, or it might be a rhino. And so to carry all the books in the practice vehicle was difficult.
Right.
So it was always exciting.
It was always exciting. Okay. So we're going to take a break now and give Henry a glass of water. And we'll be back in a few minutes. This is Bernie Wides, the naturalist. And my guest today is, I can still call you doctor, right?
You can.
Dr. Henry Kaplan, who was a veterinarian. And we'll be back in a few minutes. Cancer Naturalist. I'm back on now with my special guest today, Dr. Henry Kaplan, who has some great stories to talk about his practices. I don't mean personally your practices, Henry. Your practices with the animals. And when we took a break, I asked Henry if he worked on birds, and he said that they had their own bird person, really, to work on it. But so you spoke about kangaroos, and tell me about the white rhino, because they're really an endangered species now. Sure. Were they back in those days, too? Or
absolutely. Yeah. Very much so. And in order to get a rhino, you had to get a special certificate in order to bring it into the United States and then to raise it. And the reason for that was they're very, very endangered. And the Catskill Game Farm had a huge amount of acreage on which they had a program for endangered species where they would take the animals out of public view and then try and get them to reproduce. And the white rhino, when I was there, was the beginning of what was supposed to be a program to reproduce white rhinos in captivity. Mm. And frankly, I don't know how successful it was, but the rhino did very well. I saw him for about a year after he arrived, and he was in very good condition, in very good breeding condition. Mm. So it was working very well with rhinos. I don't know whether they breed well in captivity, but he was an excellent young rhino to breed.
He was a male?
Male.
Okay, so where was there a female also? Or they were,
well, they were hoping to get a female.
Get a female.
Or there is a very distinct, specific network between zoos and game farms where they will exchange animals for the purpose of reproduction. And obviously it's a coup to have the pandas that you see down in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. or these rhinos, and they're very careful with them. And so if a zoo like the Catskill, or a game farm like the Catskill Game Farm, has a quiet place that resembles their home country,
their home range,
and can put two animals safely together during breeding season, they're very apt to get loans from other wild animal parks and zoos.
Yeah, and since they had a big piece of property, so there was plenty of range room for the rhinos.
Yes, and many of the animals that were sick, they would have a place where they would be taken out of public view. They had a large population of elk and gazelles and things like that. And if any of them were not well, they would get them, transport them to these very quiet, isolated areas where they were able to heal and then be put back in public view.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the mortality rate like for the animals there? Did they lose a lot of animals?
Actually, they did not.
They didn't.
The care was excellent, and the diet, they had a dietitian. You can imagine the difference in diet among these animals, especially something like koala bears, which only eat eucalyptus leaves,
right.
Things like that.
Or bamboo for the pandas.
Bamboo for the pandas, yeah. Exactly right. So that was the big thing. And actually, the mortality rate on some animals, and most animals that were at the game farm, was very low. In fact, their lifespans were much longer. We're now finding out that dolphins and whatever don't do very well in captivity.
Right.
Their lifespans are shorter. But many of the animals that were brought to the Catskill Game Farm lived a long time.
Yeah, no predation. They didn't have to worry
about
that. And so,
exactly.
They, and they had all the feed they could handle, so
that's correct.
No starvation and no deficiency diseases.
And obviously diseases were caught very early.
Right.
As you know, I was in small animal practice, dogs and cats, for a long time. And many times your dog will just lie in the corner and you say, oh, he's getting older, or he just is having a bad day. And so veterinarians, unfortunately, get diseases in later stages than do humans, where if your wife says, I just don't feel right, well, we say, let's go to the doctor, theoretically.
Right. Yeah.
But with these animals, they were observed on almost a minute-to-minute, certainly hour-to-hourly basis. And if they started showing signs of lameness or inflammation or an abscess or ringworm or whatever, they were caught very, very early. So that was a big help to the veterinary care.
Yeah, speaking of care, what about dental care? Did you do that also?
We did.
You were trained to do dental care also?
Yes.
Right? Extractions and whatever else there
yes.
was.
Yes. And that was a major problem with some of the animals, because especially kangaroos or things, hay-eating animals, a piece of the hay would get up along the side of the tooth and push up into the dental sinus, and you would get a dental abscess. And for those, we would use anesthesia and use the same things we did in dogs, dogs and cats, and either extract the tooth or lance the abscess and drain it and put them, as you suggested, on antibiotics. And quite often that worked very, very well. With horses, what we would do with anything related to horses like zebras and Przewalski horses, which are very rare breed of horse that was endangered, we would do what's called floating the teeth. Mm-hmm. And floating the teeth, you would put a mouth gag in the horse, which is essentially something that fits like a halter, but it's got metal plates that when you separate the plates, it holds the mouth open.
Ah, that's good.
And gives you access to the teeth,
right.
Safe access.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, is if a horse rears up and brings this down on your head, it's not so safe for the
not
veterinarian.
So safe, right.
So they have to be restrained, but with the zebras and the Przewalski horses, we would then take what looks like a big carpenter's rasp and file the teeth. It's called floating. The term is floating. But horses, especially as they age, tend to form points on the edges of their teeth. That's many times why they die, is they can't chew. The point is sticking into the opposite gum.
Oh, okay. Oh,
and they can't masticate their hay.
Right.
The grasses that they live on.
They need a nice flat surface.
They need
like
a flat surface.
A grinding surface.
So we would go in there and float these, file off these teeth.
Yeah.
And so actually would prolong their lives because of that.
Yeah, so out in the wild, they would probably die.
They would die because they just couldn't chew. They would waste away and become prey because they couldn't run as fast or as far.
Right.
And obviously the wolves or whatever that were preying on these species would be able to catch them and pull them down. And
right. So that's what a predator does. It keeps the herd in good shape, really.
That's correct.
By going after the sick and the old. Right.
So absolutely.
You think we should do that in this society? I don't know. We're getting to the age where we should be winnied out or not winnied. That's
well,
not
they
the
talk about it. They talk about Eskimos putting their old people out on ice floes. And now that I'm that age, I'm not so sure I approve of that anymore.
No. We want to stick in as long as we can.
As long as we can. I want to make my kids as miserable as they made me.
Right. Even if we have to have our teeth filed down.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's interesting also. And I once visited this guy who was doing research on moose on the Isle Royal National Park. And in the wild, which this was Isle Royal and it was still wild, there was this balance between the wolf population and the moose population and the spruce trees. Because if you got too many moose, okay, they would chew up all the spruce trees and then they would slowly starve to death, okay? So the wolves had the job of keeping that herd just the right size.
Yes.
So it was this balance between the three of them. It was like a dance.
Unfortunately, the balance in many places now is interrupted by humans.
Right.
And so whether it's taking their range or making too much noise to have them want to reproduce or fouling the air and fouling the water and the DDT with the eagles having effects that we don't even know that we're having.
Right.
That balance, unfortunately, is shifted where man has to go in and allow a certain amount of deer to be killed, otherwise they will overgraze or things like that, where rabbits would take over if we didn't thin the herd and things like that. So that system is not allowed to work, but nature obviously had a very natural balance that worked very effectively.
Yes. Most times it stayed in balance.
Yes.
Except for unforeseen things, even in nature. You know, if you had a hurricane or a volcano erupts, there goes the whole ecosystem and then it changes. Well, but that we can't control. But like
correct.
You say, we have this job now of keeping animals in check and all that. Like, I'll give you a best example. Fire Island, New York, had this deer herd overrunning the island because there were no checks and balances on it. There were no predators at all. There was plenty of food. They would eat your flowers and your garden and your tomatoes and everything else. So what they did was they were doing the artificial birth control for these folks. They would capture some of them and give them pills and try to check the herd that way. They couldn't have a hunting season out there because the population's too dense. So they have been able to bring down the population by putting birth control in some food for the herd. Yeah. So that's one attempt to do it.
That's a very common way to control a population in the wild. We had, when I was a veterinarian, we had a tremendous problem with rabies that was moving up from the south, and it was being carried by mainly raccoons, but also foxes and things like that, animals like that. And what they did, they would, from airplanes, they would drop bait that had something that would sterilize the raccoons and the foxes because they couldn't capture them. And what would happen is that would cut down the population. And then if you could vaccinate enough percentage of the population, you would reduce the incidence of rabies.
Yeah.
And it was predictable. It was moving about 3 miles a year coming off the Delmarva Peninsula, which is the combination of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, where they come together. And someone had, a hunter had killed a raccoon, had taken the pups, I think they're called, and brought them up to his home in Pennsylvania and set them loose in Pennsylvania. And they were carrying rabies, and the rabies started to move toward New York. Mm. And so New York was very concerned about it and started to sterilize the raccoons as such.
Yeah, so what about on the game farm? Did you have to give them rabies shots?
Yes.
You have wolves and foxes who are sort of related to dogs?
Did. Yes, and rabies vaccine, we had to use killed vaccine. There are two kinds of rabies vaccine.
Attenuated,
One is modified live virus, and one is killed. And obviously, modified live virus, it would be very unusual, but you're using it in an unusual species.
Mm.
So even though the virus is modified, that it can't cause rabies in dogs and cats, you don't quite know what's going to happen in a fox. So we always use killed vaccine, which has to be used more often, but it does not carry the possibility of it mutating and causing rabies in an animal where you're not sure quite what the response will be of the animal to the vaccine.
The reaction to it.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to take another break now. And I don't know how much time we've used. I'll have to check and see, Henry. But this has been terrific. I'll just stop it for a second. And then we'll maybe come back for one more show. Back on the air again, and my guest today was Dr. Henry Kaplan, talking about his practice, which is unusual. I think it would probably be similar to a circus practice. Where, how do the circuses do? Do they keep a vet with them?
They're required by law to have veterinary care, and quite often they'll get a local veterinarian that's committed to the idea of helping them when they're in a local area, but they definitely have to have a veterinarian available to them. I was also a racetrack veterinarian.
Really?
For a friend of, for actually my cousin-in-law at Yonkers Raceway. And they also have to have a veterinarian on the grounds when they're racing. In fact, that's what I was a substitute, so that if the veterinarian couldn't come for some reason, got caught in a snowstorm, or was sick, they can't run the races. Everything stops if there's no veterinarian. So, yeah, anytime you have animals like that, there has to be veterinary care.
Yes. Okay. Now, I wonder about in Central Park, we have these horses that pull the carriages. Everybody
yes.
loves it. But there are rules that over 90 degrees, the horses can't work because it's just too hot and, you know, they work pretty hard up there. But I wonder if they have to be checked by a vet also. I'll have to find that out if they really can do it. So, Henry, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting, specifically if you mention horses. We lose about 90% of our heat through breathing out. We breathe warm air out and have about 10% of our heat loss through sweat.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever notice, at a horse race, you never see a horse racing with its mouth open. They do not lose any heat through their expiration. They only lose it by sweating.
By sweating.
So, and they don't lose it through their feet, obviously. We lose some heat through our feet, as do dogs. If you notice when dogs walk and they're hot, there will be a wet mark where they've stepped.
Never noticed
Horses
that.
Don't. Obviously, they have hooves. So they are very susceptible to heat. And so you have to be very careful using them in hot, humid conditions.
Right.
It's very difficult for them to get rid of the heat.
Yeah, well, like New York City in the summer is hot.
And humid.
Humid conditions.
Yes.
So that's why they have this regulation that
yes.
over 90 degrees, the horses can't work.
Exactly.
Which I think is a great idea. Tell me your views on things like zoos and circuses and stuff like that. Do you think it's inhumane, or do they get such good treatment that it's all right to have animals in captivity in zoos and aquariums and all that stuff?
Sure. When Bernie and I were kids, zoos were prisons. They were little cages with bars that people stood pressed up against the front of. The animals had no protection. They were always available. And they were pretty awful, to be honest with you. Rodeos, I don't want to get into which is a hot subject right now, especially where I live. At one time, were quite inhumane with the calf roping and the steer, where they would take these steers and throw them to the ground, and calf roping and things like that. Circuses have always been pretty well regulated, but the most dangerous animal in a circus are elephants, and we now know that elephants really don't do well in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
They require that they have a social network, that they do much better when there are other elephants.
Right, they have a family network.
A family, right? Yes. They're very intensely family-oriented.
Matriarchy, I think.
Exactly.
It is.
So I can say that there are exemplary zoos now that take excellent care of their animals and replicate what would be their natural environment. And I think those, especially for endangered animals that are going to disappear, and we have no other possibility but to take them in and take care of them to make sure that our kids and our grandchildren will be able to see them. I think zoos and game parks operate and fulfill a very necessary function in society, but they should be very well regulated, and they should be required to allow these animals to get away from the public and be quiet and secluded for acceptable periods of time.
That's a good idea for humans, too.
I need that.
You got to get away in a quiet little place and just relax and nothing. Okay, so, in rodeos, you mentioned. I mean, as a kid, I used to love to go to rodeo with my father in Madison Square Garden.
Sure.
It was so exciting. But there's still rodeos around the country. I remember traveling around and still seeing them, and they're doing the same stuff. Like I said, calf roping and tying the steers on, you know, three legs and they
yes.
flip them over, all that. That doesn't seem too humane to me. But.
Okay. Well, I live in, right now, I've retired to California, and we've got a big battle going on about the humane treatment of the animals. I can tell you that there are laws requiring how often a bucking horse can be used, which were not there when you and I were kids.
Right.
They would use them day after day after day. Now they can only be used once every so often. And these bulls that the bull riders ride, and they have the temperatures are regulated, and they can only put them on certain railroad cars for so many hours, and they have to have feed and water, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, there are still things that certainly from sitting in the stands look humane. Whether a calf wants to be thrown on the ground like that without breaking its ribs or being bruised, I don't know, and I'm not knowledgeable enough to comment, but certainly I would question whether some of those events are humane.
Yeah, okay. So I don't think we'll get into bullfighting because that's a whole nother story
and
a whole nother culture.
It is.
Right? So
yes.
we'll leave bullfighting for the Spanish and the Portuguese and,
yes.
and those folks who enjoy it so much as a national
It's a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing.
Yes.
So we won't comment on that. So I think we'll wrap it up now. And I want to thank you, Henry, for helping me with this broadcast. And this is the Heritage Radio Network. And the program has been The Naturalist. And this is Bernie Wides. And we're signing off.